So eternal life is his way of talking about how do we face this working with what he called bad habits at the end of the previous chapter. And he's trying to explain it. So he's transitioning from this sense of non-self that is always we're bumping up against our reactive habits in the midst of ongoing changing. So how can this non-fixed, non-permanent self, and yet we have an ongoing sense of self, how does that happen? So he's trying to deal with this in a way which is from a very deep practice perspective, but we have to remember we're talking about a practice perspective of the 5th century Common Era. So we're not talking about a practice perspective that comes out of modern science, but it's, though it seems different, it deals with the same issues that in a sense the biological scientific findings of the present day, genetics, DNA, ghost DNA, epigenetics, to name just a few, all try to clarify how habits, reactions, biological and psychological tendencies manifest and are transmitted. The Buddhist perspective that he's trying to clarify and simplify is dealing with this very same thing. What's the nature of this universe coming together at this moment in the way that it does? But, and we have to know that this is really a fundamental point in Buddhist tradition, because when the Buddha, the historical Buddha, talked about his awakening, some aspects of that is about seeing so-called past, whether you call it past lives or whether you call it past circumstances that come together to manifest in this moment. Just like, for instance, in the 19th and 20th century science of Darwin, of DNA and genetic discoverers like Crick, etc., psychologists and psychoanalysts, even to the, you know, people like Freud, etc., trying to deal with and clarify how does the past manifest as now. So, for instance, Darwin is looking at what is the evolution that leads to humans being the way they are now. Now, of course, this is an ongoing process. Even now, we only know a little bit about what aspect of our DNA contributes to what physical and mental abilities and conditions. And even less we know about how this manifests in the physical world. It's the sort of the cutting edge of genetics. So in another sense, what he's talking about, where he cites Vasubandhu and other, this is schemes in Buddhism, such as, he cites consciousness only book. There's others that deal with womb consciousness, etc. They're trying to talk about what is it that this present moment is in its connection to the universe and to all sorts of pasts and future. So he's going to express it in a form which might seem very strange to us, because it assumes certain things, and yet he's trying to make it simple and therefore make it useful for our practice. So he talks about this wave Now, I'll talk about the wave on Saturday and Sunday, but I'll talk about it a little differently than he is. He's trying to talk about the conservation of energy, which is a basic physics point of view. He says, our life is illustrated as a wave. A wave rises when the energy of the wind passes through the water. That wave, in turn, by its energy, produces the next wave. This is all the cause and effect. And there's that important point, he says, a little further down, and this is the paragraph, page 24, where he says, no energy is ever lost. Now, some of you who are scientists or know science, that's a basic physics and even quantum physics point of view. No energy is ever lost. It just changes form. But that's the basic practice point that he's saying. And he's going to elaborate on. So let me stop for a second. Since you've all read this, I don't want to repeat what he says, but I'll rather let you talk about it in the way, to the extent that some of it doesn't make sense or does make sense, or you find it useful or you don't find it useful. Just understand that what he's talking about in one sense is a consciousness or experience, but not in the personal sense, because that's, he just spent the previous chapters trying to clarify that it's not personal, even though that's an assumption we have. And that's, in a sense, the most common assumption we have, that the I that I am is the same I that I was yesterday or will be tomorrow. And he'll go on and talk about that. So let me stop here and let you say what you have to say, because I'm sure you have a lot more to say than I do about this. And he explains it quite well.
Well, for me, this is like a wow chapter.
Good.
And we have, you know, gone through those first two chapters, and I was struggling with those.
Uh-huh.
And finally, when we get down to this energy and movement and an explanation of karma I've never experienced, but it seems to feel right to me, I'm happy.
Good. Now, no one has to agree with any of this. If there's something here that's useful, take it. If there's nothing here that's useful, fine. He talks about this at length, and it's very much tied up with an attempt in the Buddhist tradition and by, you could say, deep thinkers in the Buddhist tradition to try to clarify, to make sense of certain basic aspects of the Buddhist teaching, whether it's early or late, whether the whole Alaya Shikhi or Alaya Vijnana storehouse consciousness is to attempt to deal with the same thing, in a sense, that Darwin and Crick are trying to deal with, is how do we transmit tendencies. We accept it all very easily now. Oh, yeah, your DNA results in you being born in such and such and having these tendencies, and yet these changes in the DNA result in these changes. But that's with the scientific method, and their attempt is to try to explain this and deal with this from a different perspective. Now, as I said, it's a matter of what is it useful in allowing you to live your life in a way that's compassionate and less caught up in harming and suffering.
I enjoy the way he referenced the
that second law of thermodynamics, you know, matter is neither created nor destroyed, just changes form.
Uh-huh.
I really enjoyed the way he kind of integrated that into this. I never really thought of it that way, and it was very interesting to me, especially at my age, speaking as a father and uh-huh. a grandfather. I never really thought of it that way, our energy isn't, you know, the energy of our life really isn't destroyed. It's just, in a way, transferred throughout the generations. I thought that was very touching. I enjoyed that.
Now, you have to know he has, not just Yasutani, but his teacher, Harada Roshi, had little or no science training. So this is all comes out of Buddhism rather than out of science. Only the most glancing awareness of modern science. And of course, when this was written, genetics was a mystery for the most part, except for those who were in that particular scientific study. And this is also to his way of expressing the ideas of cause and effect, and also our relatedness to the universe are not separate being in the universe. So it builds on the earlier non-fixed permanent self, non-separate fixed permanent self. So to see the interconnectedness and interrelatedness of our life, not in one sense it's theory, but in another sense he emphasizes it's a matter of experiencing this, that his theory is just theory, but we each have to sense this for ourselves in order to be able to live this. Otherwise, not going to do much for what he calls our bad habits, or what Joko calls self-centered dream or entanglement.
Yeah, I wonder how much he knew about biology sometimes reading him. Because, I mean, we know now that, you know, every molecule in our body is a different molecule than we had 10 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And we talk about, you know, a permanent fixed self. Well, that in itself screws that idea.
Well, I can't say what he knew or didn't know, but yeah. Certainly he wasn't well versed in it, and it wasn't something, and it wasn't well known then. Remember, he wrote this in 66, and much of this is based on stuff from the 30s or the 20s even. I mean, his emphasis, for instance, he talks about these two different perspectives, Jokan, what he calls is the concept of permanent existence, and Dankan, the concept of absolute destruction. And he says both are misunderstandings. This is on page 25. And he says, from a Buddhist perspective, is our life is created and destroyed moment to moment with, quote, a new self continually being formed. And he says, while most of us hold to a permanent self while we are alive, that is self-centeredness or ego, and then in terms of what's going to be after we die, well, some then also hold on to the idea life is ended and completely destroyed, and he says thus their mistake is double. But
isn't he trying to draw a distinction here between what he calls eternal life and what we want to think of as permanent self.
Yes, and he makes that point. If you think that afterlife, a specific entity such as a soul still exists permanently, that's still holding on to that as opposed to ongoing cause and effect, new. I mean, and then he uses that example, which I think is very interesting, where he talks about, let me see if I could find it. It's in the next chapter, where we in the chapter called Continuous Sweep Like a Waterfall, where he talks about even though you might think that when you get up and walk across the room, it's one person. It's really, he says, it's more like, and he uses a modern example, it's more like those flashing lights, or you could say like a movie projection, which is one moment, but all that is a flashing light, that in one sense we think is a continuous person walking across the room, but in another sense, he says, it's not like that. That's just a fiction of our way of seeing it, just as we think there's a continuous person on the screen, or there's letters on a billboard, etc. And he says, that continuity, I mean, it's fine to operate on that basis, but if we hold on to that, we get into trouble because it's not accurate.
You know, all of this just bumps up against my Catholic training from early youth.
Yes.
You know, eternal life, you kept hearing about eternal life in your soul. And this is an aside, but I remember in first grade, the nun was talking about your soul. And Mother used to like raw turnips, and she would slice them, you know, round disc. Uh-huh. And every lunchtime in my lunchbox would be some raw turnips. And so I imagined the soul was like this brown turnips. I mean, because he had no idea. And, you know, we live with that for a long time.
Yes. We do have no idea. And yet, we think we do have an idea. In one sense, I mean, his example, as I said, I'm going to use this wave ocean thing a little to talk about on Sunday, but in one sense, it's I gave a talk at a Catholic church last week, and the person introduced, it was part of a class led by a former nun, and who had some experience with Buddhism and with Zen, and she tried in an attempt to give an example for the Catholics. This is what was the audience was essentially the Catholic parish. She talked about Zen koan, and then she says, "Well, for instance, I could give you a Catholic koan," which she says, if there's the whole ocean and we take some of the water of the ocean and we put it into a bottle, what do we have? Anyone have any idea?
We have the ocean.
Well, but as a Catholic koan, what is the water in the bottle?
Holy water.
No. So she said, Jesus Christ. So, in one sense, that's not a bad answer, as long as we could say, that's my life, you could say, is the water in the bottle. But if you just say it's just Jesus Christ, that's where Yasutani says, then you still think that there's some soul that's permanent. Just pour the water out of the bottle, and then you're back all in the ocean, which you always are. So these sorts of images are images to use, but not to get caught by. Let me just also make a point that if in the pagination here, that they have we're in chapter 3 and we're reading, there's an eternal life A and there's an eternal life section C, but I don't see a section B. So it's not missing. They just, mislabeled it. They called it by the wrong bottle name. So, but it's useful to just look at all these things, and it's fine to use the word soul or spirit or whatever word it is, as long as we don't get caught in an idea that goes along with it that we don't realize, an idea of permanence or an idea of separateness, and yet at the same time, see when we are caught in that, what we're doing when we react based on that. That's the point of his discussing this, and using these images, whether it's the image of the ocean and the image of the storehouse consciousness, or Alaya Vijnana, or Alaya Shikhi, and the next image, which I'm not sure we'll get to today, in fact we won't, but the waterfall, which I think is another useful image. Again, the point is to enable us to get beyond our usual images and ideas so that we can face our life at the moment.
It kind of lost me in this next section a little bit with what you're talking about now, with the shiki, the eye, ear, nose, tongue. I mean, that sounds like what we say in the Heart Sutra, but the conveyor.
Well, what he's talking about is so it's really about the perception, what we're perceiving, and the process of perceiving.
Yeah, I understand that part.
And then he's trying to say, well, how does that process give rise to something else? And that's where he's talking about, in a way you could say it's theory and you don't have to go any further with it, but in a sense it's...
Correct.
What?
It seems a little abstract.
It is abstract. It's an attempt to talk about how is it possible that experiences somehow give rise to something else.
What page are you on, please?
26, 22.
25, 26, 27.
Okay.
And it's a way to express it. You don't have to hold on to any of this. Simply see it as an attempt to elaborate in order to help us make sense if we need to. If we don't need to, then don't bother with it. It's okay.
He had read Freud.
What?
I don't know, I got an inkling that he had read Freud.
No, this long predates Freud. This is from the 5th century and the 6th century and the 7th century. It's from India and China. There's many sutras that deal with this Alaya Vijnana, this Tathagata Garbha, womb storehouse or womb Buddha, where womb, W-O-M-B, in other words, or storehouse. that's the Alaya Vijnana, or the repository, as he puts it.
His interpretation. He brings up the unconscious and...
Yeah, but he's bringing that up, or maybe his translator is bringing that up to help us see the similarity that there's something that now people are talking about that is similar to that.
Okay.
So, for instance, there's Jung talks about collective unconscious. So he says, I understand a little about general psychology connecting to this. But certainly Jungian psychology talks about collective unconscious. Freud doesn't so much. We don't have to go elaborate on something we can't find, except to the extent that it helps us clarify and be comfortable with the fact that out of nowhere, so to speak, something arises that we don't understand and yet seems to have such strong effects on our life. Whether it's we talk about it in terms of subconscious, unconscious, collective unconscious, shadow, and then we start looking for physical equivalence or connectedness. Just like when we look at DNA and we try to see which parts of the DNA give rise to certain aspects of our being human. And we've discussed, we know how little we know of it. Or we know that it's really a whole bunch of factors. Just like they look for what are the DNA portions that give rise to certain diseases, and they can't. Or even with the brain, we used to think that there's just a specific place in the brain where certain senses are, and now they discover that it's much more complex than that. And it's not just the brain, but it's also the neural system and more. And that there's all sorts of DNA that we have. I mean, they've got this concept now called ghost DNA that somehow is manifested in our life, and yet there is no... Well, I won't try to explain genetics that I only understand a little, but it's there and yet it's not there. They could trace it, but they can't find all the physical aspects of it. I'll let you, if you're interested in that, just look up. I'm sure if you look up ghost DNA on the internet, you'll find lots of information about that or about genetics and DNA. The point of all this is for us to be able to feel a little more clarity in how life produces life, even when so-called energy seems to cease, whether before we're born or after our death. Or even each present moment, moment by moment, when yesterday's body is gone, or this morning's body is gone, and we only have this afternoon's body. And yet somehow there seems to be something transmitted, and yet there is no physical transmission that we can, or there's only limited extent where we could see the physical transmission. And that's part of the reason he uses the image of the wave to talk about how there's transmission of energy without transmission of matter. And of course, that's a common delusion that we think the waves are moving forward. And yet, to a great extent, water is just a up and down rotation with transmission of energies, just like on a much simpler level, you could say billiard balls, when you hit billiard balls, the cue ball hits the ball, the other, let's say the eighth ball, and the eighth ball moves, but the cue ball it doesn't become the eighth ball, and yet the energy is transmitted. And if you're skilled at using the energy well with the way you hit it and hand-eye coordination and the spin you put on it, you can direct those balls in different ways, and not just one or two, but you could do a whole series of balls. And it's all a matter of our mind manifesting in the shooting, etc., etc. Okay, I'm going on, and I thought, so why don't we say next week we'll do section 3, number C. It says C, I don't know if it is or it isn't, on page 30, eternal life, continuous sweep like a waterfall. It's again attempting to clarify this birth-death. And birth-death both in the longer sense, but also, as he calls, momentary birth-death. I talked a little bit about this, but he goes into it to a much greater extent. And again, it gets a little complex. And if you can also begin the law of causation, which is, what should I say, intimately tied with this. Remember, as he said from the very beginning, these are eight different aspects, or as I would say, facets. So they're all interconnected. So each chapter is really another facet of the same matter. Anyone else want to say anything? I've been talking too much.
Well, this is Lynn, and I'll just say that I really appreciate the fact that you're willing to share this text with us and invite the discussion on it. I'm familiar with some of it from things in the past, and it has really influenced my view of the world and myself, but I hadn't seen this particular rendition of it in a way that really comes from a Buddhist perspective. So I appreciate your willingness to take us through this.
Good. Thank you. You're welcome. Anyone else? Okay, so we'll stop here. We will have a class next week, and then we'll skip a week because we'll be in Sesshin. So, and if any of you can join us for Sesshin, I'd be very happy for that. Good night.
Good night.